Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on other informative and entertaining programs you may be interested in. But right now, here's your podcast.
This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, and I'm speaking to you from Liverpool, the European capital of culture. That's a surprise, isn't it? Well, not if you're actually here, because it's an amazingly cultural city. Old buildings, spectacular ones, and lots of life. In fact, when I arrived in Liverpool last night, I saw a crowd of something like 500,000 people looking up into the sky just by the station, and there was a gigantic spider, a mechanical one, something like the size of 7 buses, a huge thing crawling up the side of a building. Of course, it was a robot spider, and everyone was in the street with the odd tinny or two and having a wonderful time. The place is the venue now for the British Festival of Science, which I attend every year, and something that represents not just British science, but European science in general. And of course, there's competition this year because over in Geneva, there's the Large Hadron Collider, which is going to have the experiment almost of the century, starting off a nuclear quest. So an awful lot of people who are normally at the British Festival of Science won't actually be here. However, I know it's a bit predictable to start with the Beatles, but one of the reasons I did so is that the festival organisers piggybacked on the Beatle reputation of this city of Liverpool to say that it actually triggers, this music triggers memories in the brain, and somehow there's a justification for it, which we'll find out a bit later. So let's go to the University of Liverpool and the British Festival of Science. So the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. Quite appropriate, you'll be surprised to hear. With me is Dr. Orlaith Fraser. Now, Orlaith's a wonderful name. Where does it come from?
It's an Irish name.
And you study chimpanzees, and let's get this right, consolation behaviour. In other words, making upset chimps feel better when they've had a fight.
Well, we've just shown that this behaviour, actually approaching a victim after a fight and hugging them or embracing them, reduces their stress levels and calms them down. And this is the first time that we've actually been able to show that this behaviour has this calming function.
Where did you do this study, amongst the chimps, in the wild or where else?
No, this is actually done in captivity at Chester Zoo on 22 adult chimpanzees housed there.
I suppose you got to know them quite well over the 18 months or whatever, with names and so on?
Yes, I know them very well, better than my own family sometimes.
And what kind of pattern did you get? Was it just the family consoling its relatives, or was it amongst mates, or what?
Well, it was mainly between friends. So those individuals who shared food with each other or spent time grooming each other were more likely to offer this consolation.
In what kind of situations did it occur?
Well, it could be a fight between two chimpanzees. It could be over anything such as somebody who's sitting in your place, perhaps. It might be over a female, more likely. This can range in how aggressive it is. They might hit each other, bite each other, trample on each other. It's all very noisy in chimpanzees and doesn't really involve that much actual aggression. It's mainly for show. But after this fight, the victim can be really quite stressed. It's worrying after a fight has taken place. And so you might have a third party, somebody who wasn't involved in the fight, will approach the victim and then actually console them by embracing them and hugging them and reducing their stress, calming them down again.
How do you know it calms them down and reduces stress?
Well, we looked at their levels of self-directed behaviour, that is, levels of scratching or self-grooming. Just as in humans, if you get very nervous, you might perhaps scratch your head, you might bite your nails. In chimpanzees, you can also do kind of very similar behaviour, so they scratch more when they're stressed. So we looked at how often they scratched after a fight, and then we looked at what happened after they were consoled, and we found that their levels of scratching were actually reduced back to normal levels after this consolation had taken place.
And this means the chimps could actually recognise distress. They have a sort of theory of mind, perhaps?
Yes, well, it suggests that they're able to recognise distress and to know what to do in order to relieve that stress. So it's possible that this is actually an expression of empathy, that they're able to do something to console another individual.
Do they do this in the wild as well?
Yes, they do. They do this in the wild as well.
Presumably from your name, you come from Ireland?
My mother comes from Ireland. I was actually brought up in Luxembourg.
I see. How long have you been in Liverpool?
The last 4 years.
And would you accept that it's a capital of culture?
I think it is. I think it's done a very good job this year of actually showing how cultural it is. And there have been a tremendous amount of cultural events put on for this particular year. Yes, I think we should be proud of our capital of culture this year.
Yes, it's a very lively town, I must say, and it's appropriate that our first discussion should be about creating loving care. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether this was an evolutionary way that led to us. It's the way that we can recognise distress and do something about it, so you actually make society cohere rather than fall apart.
It seems that way, yes. These chimpanzees behave the same way as small children do. So it seems as if it has evolved very early on, in that our closest relatives, the chimpanzees, can perform these behaviours just as we do. And indeed, this is an important part of keeping groups together. Groups need to stay together in order to find food together and to protect themselves from predators. So this is all part of an important way of stopping fights from escalating and causing damage to relationships.
And of course, the first about this is that you've shown it reduces distress, but this kind of behaviour does occur in other creatures, does it?
It does, yes. It also occurs in bonobos, who are equally closely related to us, and in gorillas, and recently has been shown in rooks and in dogs as well, actually, though we don't know that it actually reduces distress in those species.
Isn't it interesting, rooks, the crow family, which is shown more and more to have this amazing intelligence.
Indeed, they're very intelligent animals, and it's fascinating. In fact, one of my next steps is to look at whether this behaviour occurs in ravens, also a clever member of the corvid species.
From John Moores University in Liverpool. Ole, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now let's go across, in fact, not to the British Association meeting in Liverpool, but to Cambridge, to Trinity College, to talk to Lord Rees about the future, the next 50 years.
Hello, this is Professor Martin Rees at Cambridge University, and here we are in Trinity College.
And you're still, you said you weren't going to be Astronomer Royal, but you still are.
I still am, yes. Mm.
Yeah. Let me ask you questions about your article on the future. You wrote a book called Our Final Century, with no question mark. I'm delighted to see you're writing about our next 50 years. What's your overview of the next 50 years? Should we sort of buckle down for a bumpy ride?
Well, I've never been that pessimistic, but I think in the next 50 years, the next 100 years, of course, we are entering an era which is unique in human history, unique in the planet's history, where one species, namely ourselves, has the power to affect the future of the entire planet. And we're well aware of the consequences of a growing population, consuming more energy and resources, more empowered by potentially dangerous technology. And I think the key question is to handle these issues optimally and to ensure that the benefits of globalization are fairly shared between the developing and the developed world. One of the most worrying issues, projected population growth is going to be largest percentage-wise in Africa, which is the area that can least cope with it, and that's going to lead to great inequalities between Africa and the rest of the world. But also, of course, we have the challenge of food supplies and the challenge of energy, and the need to derive our energy by ways that don't produce CO2, because if we go on as we are now, with the dominant energy supplies coming from burning fossil fuels, then the straight projections say that by 2050, the CO2 concentration will be double the pre-industrial level and still going up. And according to the best climate models, of course, that is a circumstance which gives a real risk of really serious climate change. And if you want to insure against that serious risk, then we need to take action sooner. And obviously we hope that in the second half of the century, renewable energy will have taken over. But what worries me most is the risk that the takeover by clean energy won't be soon enough to prevent the CO2 from having risen dangerously high. And that's why I think it's very important to keep banging on about the urgency of developing carbon capture and storage technology. Because, as we know very well, there are huge numbers of coal-fired power stations being built, nearly 100 last year in China, for instance, and they have lifetimes of 30 years. And if they continue to spew out carbon dioxide over that whole lifetime, then that is going to be bad news. So I think it's very important to have a Manhattan Project-scale international scheme to develop CCS technology so that we can advance as early as possible the date after which we can insist that all coal-fired power stations have that facility installed.
It is in principle doable, is it, this sort of technology?
Well, there are demonstration-scale models. There's one coming online in Germany just this week, in fact. But what has not been done is to build full-scale power stations with the technology. And what needs to happen, as urgently as possible, is for the wealthy countries collectively to make about 20 of these demonstration plants, each costing maybe $1 billion, which will test the various options for the technology, both for the capture and for the storage. And the sum involved will have to come partly from the public purse because it's too long-term for private industry to invest in it. But in the perspective of a world that's spending $7 trillion a year on energy and infrastructure and the scale of the problem, then this R&D expenditure seems very modest.
Now, the Royal Society has just had a meeting about dealing with it in terms of sky, you know, the climate control, by putting things up there, sulfates and so forth. You operate in the sky, so you would probably have a certain sensitivity about the sky being used in this way. Apart from your personal opinion, what was the general feeling in the Royal Society about the feasibility of some of that operation?
Well, just a bit of background, of course. We need to explore all possible options to see which work and to dismiss those that don't work. But there is discussion around the world of what's called geoengineering, in a sense, a sort of fallback position which accepts that CO2 is going to rise and that would otherwise lead to a rise in global temperatures and change in global weather patterns. But could we do something about this in a more direct way by, say, cutting out 2% of the sunlight, by putting sulfur in the upper atmosphere, even putting mirrors in space? Or could we do things to the oceans that would cause algae to bloom with greater concentration, etc.?
Like putting iron in, yes.
That's right. There are lots of ideas of this kind, of course. And I think it's good to study them. But I think technical problems and the scale that's needed are rather daunting. And even if it could be done, then, of course, the political problems would be very severe. So I think it's important to study them. And the Royal Society recently published a special edition of one of its journals containing some articles on this subject. But I think we're going to go one step further in that the Royal Society, which collaborates a great deal with other academies, is probably going to carry out its study with its American counterpart, the National Academy of Sciences, in order to assess the feasibility of these various geoengineering schemes. I suspect that we will end up putting a damper on enthusiasm because it's clear that there would be a whole lot of problems of all kinds in implementing these. But it's very important to make sure that any future decisions are based on the optimum scientific input. But it's well worthwhile studying all these possibilities, in my opinion, because the challenge is so great.
You mentioned a doubling of the CO2 just now. Now, some critics suggest that there is no proven link between CO2 increase and temperature rise. And Freeman Dyson is one of them. He's written, for instance, quite recently in the New York Review of Books, a beautifully written article, which, amongst other things, criticised that link. Do you think the connection is effectively proven?
Well, I'm not an expert any more than Freeman Dyson is, but I think first we do have the very detailed studies encapsulated in the IPCC reports which try to quantify the temperature rise associated with the given rise in the concentration of CO2. The uncertainty is substantial, of course, a factor of 2 or 3 uncertainty in how much temperature rise, but it seems to me that it would be astonishing if there were not a major temperature rise as a consequence of this CO2 concentration change, because the basic theory goes back to Tyndall, a British scientist in the mid-19th century. We know that CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and if we had no more than that basic idea, coupled with the completely uncontroversial evidence, the so-called Keeling curve, that the carbon dioxide concentration is rising and that it's now at a level that's higher than ever in the last 500,000 years, then those two facts themselves would, in my opinion, be sufficient to justify precautionary action. And, of course, as I say, we do have the IPCC reports which give more detailed estimates of what will happen. So I think it would be perverse to dismiss potential risk, even though to quantify it is still rather hard.
Lord Rees, Martin Rees, the Professor of Astrophysics at Cambridge. talking about the next 50 years. He's the author of Our Final Century. And as I said, we're at the British Association Festival in Liverpool, the Beatles City, the European capital of culture. With me is Roland Jackson. Should I call you Sir Roland?
You can call me what you like.
Sir Roland Jackson is the chief executive of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and your festival here in Liverpool. I'm in the hands-on exhibition centre with a whole lot of young people actually throwing paper planes. Why are they doing that?
Well, they're next to a stand that is being brought here by BAE Systems, who are trying to persuade them, I think, to become the engineers of the future. And clearly this is a way of engaging them.
I remember you once at the BA had something on the silent aircraft being developed in Cambridge, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Because what we try to do at this event is to present to the public directly and through the media the latest and the most interesting things in science and engineering, to present them, to talk about them, to debate them, and that includes an audience of all ages. So in front of you, you've got, I would guess, looking at them, 13, 14, 15-year-olds. But we go here from age 8 up to 80.
Now, what's this about the Beatles and memory with which you launched even before the BA started? What was that about?
Well, that is psychology experiment, piece of research essentially, looking at using the Beatles and their music as a way of finding out more about people's autobiographical memories.
So each song triggers something from when you grew up.
What they're looking at is what types of memory people have of the Beatles and when they first became aware of the Beatles and in what context and how that ties up to emotions and life at the times and the results that are being reported later on this week.
That coincides almost exactly with the Large Hadron Collider. Are you slightly resentful that they're pressing the button at the same time as you're having your festival?
Well, actually, that's causing a little bit of a stir in the media here because our president, Sir David King, is making quite a point in his presidential address that scientists should now, some of whom you see in front of you, should be concentrating more on solving the problems that really matter in the 21st century, the sort of problems that have been, in one sense, caused by our tremendous increase in scientific knowledge and technology over the past century. That we should be concentrating on that rather than the pure research. So he's making the point that, you know, we seem to be able to want to land people on Mars and build this huge machine under Geneva to probe the furthest secrets of the universe, but actually we'd be better off diverting our really best brains onto solving the questions that matter to humanity.
Well, that's very significant because Sir David King was chief scientist, before that a chemist at Cambridge, and now he's concentrating on these very strong environmental questions, just as you mentioned.
Yes, I mean, obviously he's not saying that we should stop fundamental blue skies research, but I think he's calling for a culture, if you like, to say that all of us should be concentrating on these big issues of climate change, disease, and the rest. And that's where science can make a difference as part of the solution, and that's where we want some of our best brains to concentrate.
Yes, just as Martin Rees was saying just now, treating carbon capture and storage a bit like during the Manhattan Project, or indeed when Florey was working on penicillin to really solve a problem, the matter of international emergency, in 3, 4, 5 years rather than at some time down the line.
Exactly. I mean, you made an interesting point about the World Wide Web and CERN, and people point to the existence of a place like CERN and say, well, this blue skies research led to this spin-off of the invention of the World Wide Web. Isn't that fantastic? I guess his point is that that invention was the invention of a brain, the brain of Tim Berners-Lee, and it did happen to take place at CERN, but if he'd happened to be working on solar energy generation at the time, he might well have had the same idea. So you can't simply say that great breakthroughs might come out of fundamental research. Let's particularly concentrate on applying that research to areas that we know matter to humanity now.
Okay, well, I'll let you get on with your executive duties. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, that was Sir Roland Jackson, who is the chief executive of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, based in London, and he's running this show. I met an old friend, Colin McElwain, who used to be at Nature, but now you've joined who?
Research Fortnite, a science policy newsletter.
Yeah, the reason I bailed you up, you saw the spider as well, didn't you? What did you make of it?
Oh, I thought it was extraordinary. It was just incredible to see the public's imagination so grasped by this device and to witness tens of thousands of people running about Liverpool all weekend chasing it with their kids and everything like that. I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah, when I came out of Lime Street Station, I arrived to see what looked like 500,000 people
staring up into the sky, and there on the side of a building that's going to be torn down, I think, there was the spider. It's huge, isn't it?
It's absolutely huge, and when it walks, it's 60 or 70 feet high, I would say, and just about as wide as that, and all the people, the crowds, have to be cleared out of the front of it as it goes along the street. Mechanical intricacy of it is incredible to behold.
You can ride on it. There were people on it too, up the building, weren't
there? Yeah, there must be. There's about 20 staff who are on it at any given time. It also spits all the time, hosing down water on people as they go by. It really is amazing. But the thing that's unprecedented about it is the extent to which the city is intrigued about it. Everybody is talking about it, taxi drivers and hotel staff and everybody in the street trying to figure out when it's going to move. I've just never known anything like that with regard to a work of art. No. Have you?
Who put it on?
I think the artist came here as part of the European City of Culture event. But of course, Liverpool is a very warm and friendly city anyway. It's a very, very communal city for such a big city. And therefore, it's become like this big community thing and everybody's out there seeing it. It's quite fun to behold.
What's a fortnightly publication that you're involved in?
Research Fortnightly covers research policy questions, what the government's up to and who's shafting whom, that kind of thing. We do that in some detail for senior people at universities who like to read about that kind of stuff.
Well, Sir Rowland was just saying that David King said, vis-a-vis the Hadron Collider, that perhaps we should concentrate as much on real big issues that we need to solve, like climate and food and those sorts of things, rather than so much on these basic questions. Do you think there is a straightforward choice like that?
Yeah, I do, actually. In fact, we're writing an editorial about that, supporting what he said in that particular regard, because there's a sense that the particle physicists have had an awful lot of resources and there may be more pertinent things that need to be done now. I think there's a lot of hype about the LHC starting up. It is a fact, I think, that there won't be another machine like that. But we have to realise that the actual fruits of this kind of activity, you're going to get diminishing returns, because the money involved to create meaningfully higher level of energy is just unthinkable, and therefore people are going to have to turn to a different set of problems. You got to remember that CERN was set up in the first place because of the Cold War and the extent to which people held nuclear and particle physics in awe in the 1950s and 1960s. Well, these days I think there are different problems that people are a little bit more concerned with.
Mind you, they did say, someone from Hadron Collider did say that per capita it works out at one beer per person per year in terms of cost.
Does that take into account the fact that none of the staff there pay any tax, or is that assuming that they do? I'm not quite sure. You get half the cost if they started paying their taxes, I think it would be one thing.
Good to meet you again. Thank you.
Hi, nice to see you too, Robin.
Colin McIlwain. And further down here, we've got animals. I'm looking at a bald eagle. And you're looking after him. So what's your name?
My name's Mickey. And this is Alaska. She's from Canada. She's about 17 years old. And she's a particularly large female. We're doing some demonstrations in the hall this morning. And we're hoping to fly her over the heads of some very small children. She'll fly particularly low, and we're hoping for some excitement in there.
And the children will duck and scream, will they?
Well, the children will duck. It just encourages her to fly a little lower, really.
I see. She doesn't actually sort of grab a mop of hair.
No. Yeah. She might take someone's wig off, but she's quite well trained. What we're trying to do is to show different species of birds of prey and demonstrate the different methods, how they hunt, catch and eat their food. So we brought a falcon with us. The bird on the end is a peregrine falcon, a British species. His name's Billy Bob. He's a male. He's wild disabled. He came from a power station near our centre in Kent, where he was rescued by the lads who worked there because he was not looking too clever when he came in. His mum and dad were feeding him on rancid pigeons, and he caught a fungal disease of his mouth called Frounce. And he was given a lot of medication, and he said a small part of his mouth cut out, and unfortunately this process went on when his own parents would have been teaching him to fly and to catch food. So he's lost that part. He'll do quite well with us. We've taught him to fly and to hunt to the lure, but he can't really be released back into the wild.
I see. So is there a particular period during which you have to learn to hunt, otherwise you miss out?
Their imprinting period. It's from the time they leave their nest at about 12 weeks to maybe about 3 or 4 months old is very crucial to them. Once that period is gone, you cannot teach them anything. It has gone in, that's the blueprint for life, You cannot teach them anything else.
It's a bit like me. I haven't learned anything in the last 30 years.
Well, that may be true. But with birds of prey, there is no right or wrong. Yeah. It's not like a dog. You can't scold them if they're doing wrong. You have to teach them the right way. And after that, if they do something wrong, it kills them.
I see.
So that's Billy Bob. That's the falcon at the end. The next is a barn owl. His name's Casper. He's now, I think, 12 years old. We bred him. He's been with us ever since. He's fully imprinted on humans. He believes he's a human. And he's extremely used to having people around him. In fact, if you go towards him, he will, rather than cower and try and get away, he will jump towards you.
Doesn't mind being up during the daylight.
No, not at all. It's quite false, really, that people look at owls and think they should be asleep at this time of day. But if you consider that if he was living in the wild, if it had been raining for 2 or 3 days, he would have to be out and about, no matter what the time was, in order to find his dinner. And if he had young chicks, 6 or 7 maybe, as they can do, he'd have to be out almost permanently. This is why a lot of birds do well in these latitudes, because in the summer we get 16, 17, 18 hours of daylight, which helps them to find their food. That's why they fly north in the summer and south in the winter, so they get these extended hours of daylight.
Your hawk's missing. I saw the hawk was here before. He's a catcher of rabbits.
Yes, the hawk, the Harris hawk, is in the hall at the moment doing its demonstration. And he's from Central America, from a unique species. They actually live in a family group. And they're extremely successful. They have a fantastic kill rate, and they're known as the wolf of the skies. And they act exactly like a wolf pack.
So they will catch more than they actually need?
They will, and they'll share food. And indeed, in order to stir the gene pool up, they will offer food to a neighbouring tribe's youngsters to call them away. Come and live with us. Life is better with us. You will get more food. And you can imagine, if you live in a small group and you don't sort of mix your gene pool up, you get inbreeding problems. So that's the way nature gets around that, yeah.
I see. So how many rabbits could they kill a day?
Well, they've only got a need, obviously, to kill one. If a Harris hawk caught a rabbit, it probably weighs twice as much as it does, and there's enough food there for 3 or 4 days. But if you were to take that rabbit away from it, it'll go on and kill maybe 5 or 6 more. If they're feeding young, they can...
Oh, that was a wonderful...
Yeah, lightening the load. I'm sorry, I have to go now, because I've got to take that other bird in and swap it.
All right, fine, out, but we just had this wonderful demonstration of backward poo from the bald eagle lifting up its bum and doing a squirt. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, that was Mickey with his birds. They're a regular visitor to the BA Festival and tremendous interest to all ages, as you can imagine, looking at these great big raptors and how they live. Now, earlier on in the Science Show, we mentioned Sir David King, who's president of the BA, how he made the statement in his presidential address that maybe we should concentrate more on really urgent issues in science rather than the basic stuff that may or may not lead to something in 10 or 20 or 30 years' time. Now, I've caught up with Sir David, who, of course, was the advisor to Her Majesty's government here in Britain on science policy, and it's a fairly far-reaching thing to say, Sir David. What did you mean by that, if I got it right?
We are faced with a series of enormous challenges in this century. These challenges are quite different from anything our civilization has had to face up to before, and in an interesting sense, these challenges arise because of the successes of what science, engineering, medicine, agriculture delivered in the 19th and 20th centuries. The result of all those successes is that we have a lifespan of around 75 to 80 years, whereas at the beginning of the century it was about 40 to 45. The consequence of that is that we started adding another billion people to the planet every 12 years. And so we entered the 21st century at 6 billion, we're today at 6.8 billion, and by mid-century, we're going to be at 9 billion. There's the new challenge. And this means that we really have to re-gear our thinking. What is critically important is that we mainstream this into all of our thinking, not just science. I mean into political decision-making, economics. Growing our GDP may be important, but controlling emissions of carbon dioxide is even more important. We need a cultural rethink. In terms of science, we need to also then examine what are our priorities. And I'm really appealing to young people and saying the opportunities in science, engineering, plant sciences, right across the board, are enormous. We've got to feed 9 billion people, all with the aspiration to live at the standard of living of the average Australian. Every Chinese, every Indian wants to have that, and so does every African. Mm-hmm. Our ability to understand the role of the Higgs boson, our ability to understand very esoteric aspects of scientific interest, is far greater, I would suggest, than our ability to understand how to generate efficiently more usable energy from sunlight to deal with problems of malaria, HIV/AIDS, which are causing millions of deaths in Africa every year. Our abilities, in other words, have skewed away from meeting these challenges. So I think we need to rethink funding in science, engineering, medicine, technology, and reprioritize so that we encourage the most brilliant minds to tackle these problems.
So, if I may say, if the Large Hadron Collider came up for funding, and you were still advising the Prime Minister, if the space station came up for funding, enormous costs, you'd say no?
I certainly worry about the fact that we find it easier to think about landing a man on Mars than to think about dealing with these problems that I'm mentioning. So, Large Hadron Collider, I wouldn't switch it off. Massive investment, very exciting. You can get young people interested in science because we're all interested in cosmology. But where is the point at which we have to say to particle physicists, that's enough? Because they could go on building bigger and bigger machines. Eventually, do they go right round the planet? Right around the equator, and then we say that's enough? Or do we let them circle it around the moon as well? It may sound absurd, but there's got to be a point at which we say, enough of that, let's refocus our energy. People say to me, but what about World Wide Web, for example, the spin-out from CERN? Well, I would say, what about taking the brilliant new imitator of Tim Berners-Lee, who developed the World Wide Web while he was at CERN, and getting him to work on these problems, he'll spin out the same things.
Now, another thing that has been obviously an issue in this festival has been your statement on genetically modified crops, and suggesting, in fact, that with all those people you mentioned in the beginning who will have to be fed and have to be fed now, it is too late to put off the GM opportunity. How far would you go with that?
My point is, agricultural technology can be geared up to deliver food for 9 billion people at a level that would satisfy them. But if we went down the route of organic farming, if we go down the route of rejecting modern technology, not only will we struggle to do that, but actually we will have to use more of our land mass to deliver the food, which means that the human footprint will actually wipe out the biodiverse system. So I'm actually putting forward the rather radical idea, I think, that we should have intensive farming of some areas of our global land and then maintain the other areas of the land for managing the biodiverse system.
How much does the green opposition to this sort of technology frustrate you?
Enormously, because I see people in Africa starving year on year. I see the fatality rate from malnutrition and from disease, from poor water conditions and poor hygiene with food, around 700,000 Africans a year dying. And we need to focus on that as quickly as we can. In other words, to develop new crops that are drought resistant, and maybe the state of Victoria in Australia could do with these, to deal with rice that is flood resistant, to deal with saline resistant plants as well, to develop these new crops and keep ahead of the diseases the crops are exposed to keep ahead of those, we need something quick, a quick tool, and GM is just such a tool. Now, if we eschew GM technology, we can get there. We can get our knees into mud, our arms up to the armpits in mud, and year after year slowly develop the new crops. But I would suggest it would take 20 years by that route, compared with a couple of years by the GM route. Why would we reject that? I say this because, yes, we need good regulation on GM products, But at the same time, I don't know of any single example of a human being ever suffering from eating GM foods, despite the fact that 6 million farmers around the world now farm GM products. So there's a large number of people eating them.
Now, you've just become head of a school of enterprise and environment. Is the job of that school to look at these very sorts of things where, if you like, it's a green business opportunity that you want to see how best you can put things together without paying the penalty, perhaps, of allowing the usual corporate route to run away with things, as they have done to some extent, as Monsanto has confessed that it did in the beginning with GM crops? So in other words, what is the remit that you have in your new school?
You describe it quite well. We have two sides to the remit, and it may be surprising. Here's the oldest university in Britain, possibly in the world, facing the 21st century. In establishing the school, the university is saying, every undergraduate coming to study whatever subject, whether it's philosophy, politics, economics, physics, or engineering, will be exposed to the 21st century challenges I've been talking about. So I have to mainstream these environmental issues into all parts of the university. And this will involve establishing new chairs of environmental economics, environmental philosophy, etc., environmental engineering. Now, at the same time, we're creating a global hub under the brand name Oxford to bring together private sector, governments, and academics to find solutions to our 21st century problems and to assist other people to find solutions. The idea is not that we will produce all the solutions, but that we will become a hub where people can gather and discuss how these solutions may emerge. A critical part of this, and I know of no other part of a university in the world which is doing this, is bringing the private sector heavily on board. So I'm developing a very big partnership board with the world's main companies sitting on it so that we can deliver. Now, of course, the private sector needs the legislation from governments to drive this through, which is why we're also working with government. I'm also establishing within the school a new futures laboratory. Right, and the futures laboratory will have two parts to it. One is developing futures methodologies. We're not predicting the future. We're working on developing scenarios into the future so that we can become more robust in government decision-making and in private sector decision-making. And then the other half of the futures laboratory will be working on futures programs. So a program of work might be, what is the appropriate mix on the electric grids for each country in Europe out to 2050. And then, of course, we'd be working with all of the utilities around Europe, with the energy companies.
How have you found the recruits, both in business and in the environmental movement? Who's the most reluctant to join you?
Well, interestingly, my biggest problem in the first 6 months in the job in establishing the school has been managing expectations, because I've had literally 100 emails a day still coming in from people around the world. So quite clearly, there is a general recognition that what we're doing is needed. So in October, we will officially launch the new Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment at Oxford. And when we launch it, I will have got 25 staff on board. I will then, I think, begin to be able to deliver into what everyone feels is necessary.
Sir David, when I arrived in Liverpool just now, I saw a giant spider crawling up a building. you know what I mean. How much in Britain have you had these giant objects running around, and what effect have they had?
This is a French company. The first giant objects they developed was a giant elephant, the Sultan's elephant, that had a building on top of its back. The elephant, about three stories high, walked all around London for about 3 days. No prior announcement was made, but one day in the middle of London, a great big hole appeared in one of the main roads, with the tar all burnt around the edges of the hole, where a rocket had apparently smashed into London. And this elephant and somebody called a little girl emerged. Now, the little girl's head is also about three stories high. And these puppets managed with the most amazing engineering, spent 3 days walking around London. And in the end, Saturday and Sunday that week, there were around 500,000 people following them as they walked around. Now, the spider is, again, wonderful that it's happening during our Festival of Science, because it's a wonderful piece of engineering. There was this enormous creature hanging off the side of a building as you arrived at the railway station.
It's really sensational. Now, you come from Liverpool, actually, originally South Africa, which is why you're speaking about the African problem with creating food and so on. But what was your experience like here at the university?
I spent 14 years here, arriving as a young man, age 34. I was professor of physical chemistry. And Liverpool had got itself into the doldrums, frankly. This great city, it was once the richest city in Europe. And I have to say, largely because of the slave trade, but also because the trade with America was largely through Liverpool. But the manufacturing base had been lost, the dockyards had been lost, and so the city was in the doldrums. Since 1970, or thereabouts, the city has been rebuilding itself. It's no fluke that this is the city where the Beatles emerged. Many, many playwrights, poets, musicians. It's an international, global dockland city with all of these cultures mixing. And that has remained. So it's still culturally a very lively city. Very appropriate that this year it's Europe's City of Culture.
It's really vibrant. My final question to you, Lord Rees, Martin Rees, the President of the Royal Society, did a book called Our Final Century with no question mark. How do you feel about our prospect for solving these global problems? Are we going to make it?
Yes, we are going to make it, and I say that almost with the same certainty as the way he omitted the query at the end of his title. You see, I think we are already seeing a tremendous interest around the world in the climate change problem, the biggest problem we've ever been faced with. We have to decarbonize our energy sources around the world within 50 years if we're going to manage this problem. I think we can do it. The excitement that this will generate in the scientific, technological, engineering community is enormous, but also the excitement in the private sector, because this is a new opportunity for the private sector. Those people who read the opportunity correctly will be doing very well for themselves, and I think this is already happening. I mean, just a final aside on that. We have a European Union trading scheme in carbon dioxide, the cap and trade scheme. And there were many skeptics. And last year, the total amount of money traded through the City of London was around 5 billion euro. Now, I thought that was quite a lot. Well, let me tell you, it's just beginning to take off. Today, it's 60 billion euro, 60 billion euro. I believe in no more than 10 years, we'll see the global trade valued at around $1 trillion. And this means that we will have a new commodity. And it'll be the only fully internationally traded commodity. The reason I'm raising this is because this would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. And here we are already moving rapidly into a new cultural sphere in which we're trading in a negative commodity in the way we've traded nothing else before.
So, David, good to see you again.
Thank you very much, Robin. Wonderful to see you too.
Well, that was Dr. David King, who happens to be president of the British Association, and formerly he was chief scientist to the British government, and now he runs the new school in Oxford of business and environment. You may have noticed that we're around the time of the anniversary of September the 11th and the crash into the Twin Towers. Well, one of the most interesting papers at the conference in Liverpool was presented by Dr. Sergei Dudarev of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. And this was about the ways in which steel is deformed by high temperatures in a way that hadn't been appreciated before and could well account for the reasons that they collapsed. What, in fact, have you found about what takes place with steel over temperatures of 500 degrees Celsius?
The most interesting aspect of steels at high temperature is that their strength turns out to be controlled by their magnetic properties. And you would not normally associate quantum mechanics with such large-scale events as building collapse. But it turns out, and this is the result of the most recent research, that the properties of steels and their mechanical strength is controlled fundamentally by their magnetic properties. And this offers an explanation for the loss of strength of construction steels in the Twin Towers, but also offers a very positive way forward, because we now understand what happened, in designing steels that would be resistant to this effect.
Well, in fact, they thought that the steel should be okay up to about 1500 degrees C.
1500 degrees centigrade is the temperature at which iron or steel melt. In the case of Twin Towers, temperatures rarely go above 500 or 600 degrees centigrade. What actually happened in the Twin Towers is, unfortunately, the thermal insulation panels were knocked off by the impact. Had they stayed in place, the buildings would have survived and nothing would have happened. It was just an unfortunate direct exposure of steel structures to temperatures of 600 or 500 degrees centigrade that caused the collapse.
Is it surprising that people hadn't realised this before? A material like steel is very, very common. It's been used for thousands of years, and blacksmiths have taken advantage that it's malleable at certain temperatures. That's how they fashion it. Why wasn't it known that this catastrophic change could occur?
In fact, it was known to engineers that if you raise temperature above, say, 600 degrees centigrade, that it is not good news for the structural steels, and this is why the thermal insulation panels were installed to protect the building from events like normal fire in the office where somebody drops a cigarette in a paper basket. But from the perspective of fusion research, which looks at the possibility of using steels at temperatures as high as 1,000 degrees centigrade, there is no possibility of installing the thermal insulation panels.
This is fusion research like nuclear reactors and so on.
Indeed, it is very similar. And what is really a new aspect is the identification of the microscopic cause of the collapse. Now, knowing this, we can design new chemically different steels where we deliberately control the behavior of magnetic moments at high temperatures and hence control the mechanical properties.
Yes, I must say the pictures you've got, the live pictures of those wobbling molecules, are quite compelling. But what do you have to do to add these which chemicals, and do you know yet how to make this super steel?
Well, it is a large European project. Our colleagues from Germany, Switzerland, France, ourselves, where we do experiments on various steel compositions. But what we learned from the research we've just accomplished is we definitely need to take a broader view at what we call steels. Most likely, quite common elements could be used in order to control the magnetic properties and hence mechanical properties.
Does this scotch some of those many conspiracy theories, I'm sure you're familiar with them, and explain actually what happened?
Well, the answer to the terrible tragedy is, had the thermal insulating panels been glued better to the steel structures, nothing would have happened, or at least the buildings could have been evacuated before they collapsed. It is a predictable outcome of very strong fire in a building where a conventional steel proved to be unsuitable for the purpose. So partially the answer might be in the use of different steels that remain stable, mechanically stable at high temperatures, or partially in the design of better protected structures using thermal insulation materials.
Dr. Sergei Dudarov from the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
And so where do you imagine we would finish this science show from Liverpool, the BA Festival? Where else? But, well, some people go to Mecca, some people go to Rome, other people go to Lourdes. Folk of my generation come to this place, the Cavern Club, where it all began over 40 years ago. And now I've come inside to a place where they're setting up actually to do a gig tonight.
They're going to play some music and they're going to talk about the ways in which these songs elucidate memories. Well, with me is Martin Conway from the Psychology Department at the University of Leeds. Martin Conway, what's it like for you being in the cavern?
Well, I think you summed it up there well. It's tremendously atmospheric, and it's a real thrill for an academic to come to a fantastic place like this.
Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. I did go to the Replica Cavern Club that they built on Albert Dock.
But what about these memories, those songs that really bring people like us back memories of what it was like back in the 1960s? How many people did you talk to find out what they felt?
Well, it was actually a web survey, so we didn't talk, but about 3,500 people emailed in with their memories and gave us some wonderful descriptions. The memories are so poignant, they're so redolent of youth, of late adolescence and early adulthood. They're full of life, except, it has to be said, for a group of memories which are related to the death of John Lennon. And they're actually the opposite. They're terribly sad memories.
I can imagine, yes, but which songs stood out? Did they name them?
Yes, they did name them. There were some interesting findings there. The most named song was She Loves You.
That's one way back at the beginning.
It is way back at the beginning. Actually, younger people in the survey, and we're talking about people in their 40s, tended to name Hey Jude more frequently than She Loves You. But overall, it was She Loves You that won the race. And North Americans tended to name most frequently I Want to Hold Your Hand.
What do you think's going on there in the brain that has music evoke memories in a way that we kind of assume, but is obviously wired in there somehow with nervous pathways and chemicals? What's happening?
Well, music's processed in various brain areas, obviously. An important one is an area called the temporal lobes, which are kind of towards the middle of the brain on the floor, so you won't be able to easily point to them. They're areas which are also very, very important in memory. So part of music is processed in areas which also process memory, and that probably facilitates memory being a very powerful cue to recalling specific events from one's past.
It's amazing that it lasts so very long, though. You know, decades, it's still there in the back of your head.
Absolutely, and I recall some very well-known cases of people who had brain damage in the area of the temporal lobes. Two people in particular, two very old ladies in their 80s, and one of them suddenly, and this is not uncommon in this disorder, thought she heard a radio on in her home and it was playing all the songs of her youth. And she couldn't understand why it was playing this music, and of course it was her memories of the music that were coming to mind. And the same happened for the other lady, and she started hearing all these jazz songs from the 20s, which it turned out she'd really rather disliked at the time, so for her it wasn't a very pleasant experience at all.
Yes, Oliver Sacks talks about that. He's talked about it on The Science Show before. And indeed, the people who have brain damage due sometimes to stroke or some other kind of malady, where, oddly enough, the memory goes, but the music is maintained somehow.
Yes, it does. And it is quite a remarkable phenomenon. We can't pretend we understand it yet. I think probably what happens is when one's recalling a memory, it engages many different brain areas. And so they're much more susceptible to brain damage, because they're more complicated, basically. So you might retain something like a tune or a song, but lose the memories associated with it.
And what are you going to do tonight here in the Cavern Club?
Now, we've got a great night ahead of us. This is organised by the British Association for the Advancement of Science. My colleague and I, Dr. Katrina Morrison, are going to report back on our web survey of people's Beatles memories to the general public. We're expecting about 100 to 120 people here.
And there'll be music played too.
There will be music played too, and I dare say there'll be a few Beatles songs played in that music. It's live music, and there'll be some food and wine as well.
Do you play?
Actually, I do, and I started to play in my early 50s. And I have a music teacher who could be my son. He's fantastic. And I can actually play Strawberry Fields.
Isn't that clever? From the later period somewhat. Is Strawberry Fields your favourite song?
It's one of my favourite songs from the Beatles era. I tend to be very much a John Lennon sort of man, so I like Lennon's later work on his own, but I loved the Beatles at the time, and A Day in the Life remains for me one of the outstanding tracks.
What about All You Need Is Love?
That's a great track too, and the bit of French at the beginning is completely inspired, the French anthem.
Martin Conway from Leeds. Well, I wonder what memories this song triggers for you. I saw it during the first ever global satellite link, being recorded with the Beatles, 25th of June, 1967. Our World, an international hookup that included the ABC and your very own science unit. That was the science show from the BA Festival in Liverpool. More next week. I'm Robin Williams.
This week on The Law Report, interpreters in the courtroom. If they get it wrong, the consequences can be enormous. An innocent accused might be found guilty or a criminal might escape conviction. Poor working conditions, a lack of qualifications and cultural miscommunications all present challenges. And for Indigenous interpreters living in isolated communities, the pressures can be huge. That's on The Law Report with me, Damien Carrick. You can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.